Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist. The Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee. We have with us our head coach, Chad Zimmerman.
Hey, buddy.
Pivot Cycles and DT Swiss's Hannah Otto.
Hi, everyone.
And we also have our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
It's going to be a good crew today. We are going to talk about carbs and fat. That's going to trigger some folks, eh, Nate? Get some people up in arms.
Now they're going to message me about it. Thanks, John.
Yeah, there we go.
Only one side messages, by the way.
Yes, that's the truth. Yeah. And to be clear, Nate didn't select this question. I did. I think it's a great one. We're also going to talk about recovery between intervals, different ways, and the science behind that. Technical skills, since we have Hannah with us, a pro that's just been like smoking the top step of a podium all over the place in multiple countries. And it's going to be good. Tons of other stuff too. If you're watching this video on YouTube right now, give us a thumbs up. We're not live today. It's pre-recorded. So we won't be in the live chat. At least I won't be in the live chat, but I bet Sean will be in there and the other crew. So we appreciate having you there. I'll check up on the live chat thereafter and any questions you have, we'll see if we can throw them into next week's podcast. And you can submit your questions every week at trainerroad.com/podcast. Okay. Hannah, first of all, you raced Missoula, which was a UCI XC race. Is that correct?
Uh-huh. Or a UCI C1. Mm-hmm.
And then you raced the Canmore Cup.
Oh. What's a C1?
Good question, Nate.
Yeah. In UCI races, they all award different amounts of points. So there's World Cup points, HC points, C1, C2, C3. And that's the biggest to the smallest. So C1 is not the highest, but still pretty darn high. It's the highest level we have in the U.S. other than the World Cup.
Thank you.
So big race. And so there's Missoula and then Canmore, which that's up in Calgary, correct?
Yes. Also a C1.
Also a C1. Cool. So both XCO races and then short tracks. Did you win short tracks too at both of them?
It did. Yeah.
Jeez. Give her a broom. That's pretty awesome. Okay. So, what did you learn from this? Because Missoula looked rainy, muddy, cold. And then from the images that I saw, Canmore did not look muddy. But what did you learn at Missoula or any of the courses? Let's just step through it.
Yeah, I think right now I'm in a big learning process, actually, across all of these wins, these last few races. And just a lot of it is in how I'm reading the course and reading the competition. So going into these races with the intention specifically to win, I think gave me a really different outlook than I might normally have. So instead of just pre-riding the course, looking at lines, looking at how am I going to ride this well, I've really started to look at courses to recognize where my strengths and weaknesses are, and then using that information to guide my efforts during the race.
What does that practically?
Tell me more about that.
Yeah. Okay, cool. They want to dig too. Yeah. What does that practically look like? Pick whichever event you want, but what does that practically look like? What changes are you doing?
Yeah. So, you could go into either race, but Missoula, for example, was a pretty long climb. And there were sections of the climb that I knew were a really great gradient for me. Just a place where I feel like my strengths really stood out. And then
does
there
that
were
mean
places
steep or not
yes,
too steep.
Steepness. I really love 5 to 8% is a really great place for me. So when it hit that and hit that gradient, I knew that that was going to be a place where I felt really strong. Then there were some undulating sections where I knew straight away, this isn't going to be my strongest place on the course. That doesn't mean it's going to be bad. It just means, hey, I'm acknowledging this up front. It's probably not going to be the place where I throw my attack. So acknowledging those and then planning my race accordingly. If everything goes according to my plans, this is where I'm going to attack. This is where I'm going to give myself a little bit more patience and understanding. And that's how I'm going to approach the race.
So can you describe that more? So the 5 to 8%, is that where you're just like, I'm going to drop everybody? Or did you attack there? And then the undulating part, did you just try to maintain and like be in a good mental spot?
Yeah, more or less. It was a multi-lap course, so I specifically had the plan of, okay, if we're still together on the last lap, this is the place that I will throw my attack. That said, on the first lap, I, and this is the next thing I learned, was reading my competition is how are people feeling, not just being in my own world, but listening and paying attention to the people and the wheels around me. I discovered earlier this year that sometimes I can be completely unaware of what other people are doing because I'm so caught up in my own world and how I feel. And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. But it's really important sometimes, especially if you're planning to win, to pay attention to others. There are times when I might throw an attack and not realize that I've gained 3 bike lengths and sit up thinking that, oh man, my attack didn't work. But actually, I just gave up this gap that I created. And so being really aware of where people are at, am I gapping them on these corners? Am I gapping them on the descent? Am I pushing them on this climb? How are they breathing even? And so specifically in Missoula, on that place where I felt good on that 5 to 8% climb, I could hear the breathing of my competition. I could feel that every time I would kind of give it a little bit, the elastic would stretch. And so I just gradually increased the pace, and there I was able to just gain a gap. And that's the best case scenario for me. I didn't have to throw in a huge attack. I was just able to really kind of turn the screws and open up the gap that way.
It feels good just to listen to that, right? I just felt like I had a successful race. It's been a while since I felt like that, you know, like, because that feeling is amazing when you can race and then like, you're fully aware and present, and you know your spots and you're making the right moves. Gosh, it feels good.
Absolutely. I also like the idea that the gap just grows. So rather, it's like your competition just, you're like, no, but it's just, it's like a dream where you're fighting underwater or something, you know, and they just can't get there, but you're the bad part of the dream.
Yeah. No doubt.
What is Dream Crusher? Yeah. That's what we'll call you.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk more about Missoula later on, because there's a question actually, and I don't know if the athlete was there or if the athlete just submitted the question, they saw it via social media or whatever they saw, but it's a good one. So we'll save for that. Let's get into Richard's question. It says, I had a question related to fat and carb utilization during longer endurance events, but probably a bit different than the typical question about fat adaptation. I'm a longtime runner turned triathlete and have so far focused on 70.3s, but with a goal to eventually finish a full Ironman. I recently completed a metabolic efficiency panel test in a lab to get an idea of how efficient I am at burning fat, particularly at relatively faster paces like my 70.3 pace. And the doctor that ran my test said that my results were weird. And then in this case, Richard says, I'd like to think in a good way. Chad, can you first explain what a metabolic efficiency panel test is? Like, like what does it look like and what are they doing?
Yeah, we kind of did it. I'm pretty sure they tie it in with a VO2 max test, but either way, you're just measuring gas exchange to see incoming oxygen versus outgoing CO2 to distinguish when you're predominantly burning fat, when you're predominantly burning carbohydrate, where in there you cut over to one being the more predominant fuel source.
Awesome. He said, I had relatively high levels of fat burning for a not fat adapted athlete, AKA someone doing keto. These are all Richard's words. But that my fat burning levels remain nearly flat all the way up to LT2, which, Nate, what's a LT2, lactate threshold 2?
Yes. When your lactate starts going faster than you can clear it, and it starts to get exponential, and pain happens.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then Richard says, thanks, Nate. That's awesome. Then Richard says, and even past my lactic threshold and my trainer road FTP, I was still burning fat. And then, which he says, the doctor said was very unusual. So I think that means I've been doing my diet and endurance training correctly. But, and this is related to my question, he said it looked like my ability to process carbohydrates was weak, resulting in a lower top end of the result. I think part of this was just cutting off the test too soon, but I was getting fairly fatigued even going over my FTP for a few minutes. Just for reference, the test protocol was to start at a low-ish power level and increase by 15 watts every 4 minutes to get to the respiratory exchange rate along with lactate levels. So my question, is carb burning ability a thing you can train? And if so, how do you do it? And also, how much does it really matter for an endurance athlete? Would training my top end pull my FTP higher? I'm trying to make sense of how I can use my test results to improve. Any advice is appreciated. Thank you. Almost before we get into, can I describe his training a bit, Chad? I think that would, and Hannah, that might give us all good context. And I know, Nate, you haven't looked at that.
I do have it wrapped into the discussion, but if you preface this whole discussion with that, it'd be useful.
Cool. Sounds good. So Richard looked at Richard's training plan. Richard, you're doing somewhere around 12 to 15 hours a week of training. So quite a lot of training. Multi-sport athlete. Right now you're following traditional base, and it seems like you're repeating the first part of traditional base. And then you're just doing your runs and swims separately. And looking at that, when you're repeating that, you're just strictly doing endurance work. And I think that you've been doing endurance work since February or March or so, and that's it. Like no breaking out of that zone, just endurance, zone two, right? And that's just where you've been at the whole time leading into this. Looking at somewhere around 5 to 7 hours, I think, on the bike, Nate, for some context. And then the rest is made up in the running and swimming. So really like a single profile in terms of recent training, single intensity profile, very much just endurance work, just doing that. That's at the
end. And what's Richard's age, FTP, and what kg?
I'll check on all that right now. I'm not sure on Richard's age, but I'll go in and I'll look at that. Chad, do you want to kick this off, or Hannah?
Let me do it first, because what I present actually dovetails nicely into what I know Hannah's going to present.
Amazing.
And then, Richard, I wish this were a face-to-face conversation, because I have so many questions and comments for you even before I get to the prepared notes. First off, your doctor said that you had relatively high levels of fat burning for a non-fat adapted athlete, someone doing keto. Are you in fact non-fat adapted? I want to know, is this something you're pursuing? Are you making actual dietary modifications? Are you maybe unconscious or subconsciously changing your diet because you're leaning more fat than carbohydrate? Becoming fat adapted is a stark transition when you heartily pursue it. But if you kind of ease into it, as I have made the mistake of doing, all it really does is keep you tethered to both worlds, and your performance just tanks because of it. So that'd be one thing I'd want to know. And then your doctor, physician, whomever said that, or whoever, he said, past your lactic threshold, trainer wrote FTP, you were still burning fat, which is very unusual. It's not. You should still be burning fat at that intensity. Past your VO2 max, I would be really surprised if you were still burning it. But I don't think, based on what you described, you can reach VO2 max right now, and I'll get to why that is. And then you conclude, I think that means I've been doing my diet and endurance training correctly. Well, that's certainly contextual. What is correctly? What are you after? Because I'm not clear. If you want to become fat adapted, if you want to shift, I mean, you're 70.3 right now. That needs a bit of sugar. It just does. If you want to go fast, you're working toward full Ironmans. That can be done fat adapted, albeit relatively slowly. So I'd like to know what exactly you're pursuing. And then just that test protocol, a 15 watt bump every 4 minutes makes for a long test if you have a high FTP. I mean, if you're on it at 100 watts and your FTP is at 200, it's not going to take you too long to get there. And that's a reasonable duration for a test like this. But man, if you're 300, 350, whatever it may be, if you're even 300, it's going to take you a long time to get there. There's going to be so much fatigue in the system by the time you reach it. I wouldn't be surprised that you couldn't actually push to what you're actually capable of reaching. Mm. Okay. So with all that out of the way, first off, I want to offer a simple answer. And that's that evidence does demonstrate that you can, in fact, diminish or improve your ability to metabolize specific substrates. And when we talk about substrate metabolism, we're always talking about fat and carbohydrate. Protein can be metabolized for energy. That's real, but it's always very low on the whole contribution. I've never even seen it referred to above 10%. And even then, it's just something that happens. I don't know if it changes when you shift your preference for fat to carb to fat, whatever that may be. I don't know that – it just never enters the discussion. So I got to believe it's not a big factor. So when it comes to carbohydrate and shaping your ability to utilize carbohydrate, just look at our previous podcast, number 360, because we talked a lot on increasing your anaerobic work capacity, and that's exactly what we're talking about here. You need to be able to work anaerobically, and that doesn't mean entirely anaerobically, not even predominantly anaerobically, just you have to be able to contribute to this whole energy draw with anaerobic resources, carbohydrate being that. Because what we might be seeing here is simply a low ability to metabolize carbohydrate on your part. And this leads to a dietarily and or even a low intensity training imposed power ceiling. So this can be something that's due to long-term changes in your diet, could be just the fact that you're doing all low intensity training. But and then actually to break that dietary side down a little more, it's lack of carbohydrate combustion, period, but that could be simply on the day. You could come into this underfueled, and that's exactly what I did when all three of us did a VO2 max test. I simply couldn't elevate. I didn't have sugar on board to do it. And in my case, it wasn't intentional. It was what I just described. I didn't realize how fat heavy my diet was going and how I was basically starving myself for carbohydrate. Jonathan?
That's a really good point. When you come into a test, your current condition as to that day will have an effect on that test. It's not like it will be able to differentiate between, oh, this morning you just didn't eat anything, and as a result, I'm going to overlook that and instead show something else. Like, what we eat doesn't have an effect on that.
And especially a potentially long test that's incremental in nature. I mean, he's just burning more and more and more carbohydrate that he may not have had on board to burn in the first place. So by the time he got to a point where he needed to work hard, the fuel just wasn't there to facilitate it.
And how much glycogen you have too. And that could be multi-days of eating plus whatever workouts were spaced before.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not to mention the long-term effects of that on training, right, Nate? Chad, when we're talking about training over time and you're able to store more. So
completely. Completely. So that's on the day. That could happen on the day. Just you came into it underfueled. It could be more of a general matter in that you are pursuing fat adaptation, or there's a lack of moderate intensity or high intensity training. You're not really recruiting the anaerobic side of things. So why would it be overly or even sufficiently developed? Having looked at your training since, and I only look back to April, Jonathan apparently looked farther back, and all the training has been Z2 endurance sort of stuff. There has been some Z3 workouts, but that's been the high end of things. And that's going to be something I'm going to expand on in a bit. So that's the carbohydrate side of things. And because we've covered that plenty of times and in great depth, especially with that podcast 360, I wanted to turn this more toward fat for a minute, because this is also something that's very shapeable. And in the case of a 70.3 athlete, and especially a full Ironman distance athlete, it's pretty relevant. And what I'm going to use is what I have used for my own benefit a number of times, which is a review article from basically the turn of the century, 1998, Rinaldo and Rhodes. And it's titled simply Lipid Metabolism During Exercise. And I like this article, and I still like this article, because it continues to set the stage for any discussion like this, even being 24 years old, because so much of it still holds true. And I can't really find anything. I recently, just a couple days ago, went over it again, and all of it still stands up really nicely. And it points out a few important things. First off, that fat metabolism is influenced by a small number of factors, and their dietary and nutritional status is one thing. We just kind of touched on that. Influence of hormones. If this were a deeper dive, I would go into that. I'm just going to leave that alone. Exercise, both the mode, running actually is found to burn more fat than riding a bike. The intensity, obviously, as the intensity creeps up, we get that interchange between carbohydrate and fat. And then the duration, as the exercise carries on and we run anaerobic stores lower and lower and lower, fat and aerobic metabolism play a larger and larger part. And then, of course, training status. Are you deconditioned? Are you highly conditioned? Are you anywhere in between? Because that can all affect how you metabolize fuel. And then just quickly, I'll touch on a paper that I'll talk a little bit more about later by Acton and Eukendrup. They add that gender can also influence this physical activity level, so the non-exercise side of things, and then numerous other unexplained factors which are going to affect it a little bit. Another point they bring up is that low-intensity training is supplied predominantly by free fatty acids. And these fatty acids of fat come from our adipose tissue. So we're talking about stored tissue breaking down to provide energy. This happens when we're working 25 to 40% VO2 max, roughly. Once we push up to about 65% of VO2 max, and this holds true across a lot of studies, this free fatty uptake by the muscle actually decreases a bit. And then when we prolong our endurance training or exercise and we work at this moderate intensity, another shift occurs that I don't think a lot of people know about, where the work is increasingly fueled by fat from muscle triglycerides. So still fat fuel, but the fat's actually coming from the muscle store, or the fat stores that have been built up in our muscles, probably through training, and then there may even be some there without training. I'm not entirely sure about that. Jonathan.
Super, super important thing that I just want to emphasize what Chad said is that as intensity increases, what this research doesn't show is that fat metabolism turns off. It changes. It may decrease slightly, but it does not turn off. This whole system of switches and faders, right? Yeah. I just want to nail that home. It was such an important point that Chad just said, and it goes against the conventional wisdom that I believed at one point and that I see, and even in this question, we see mirrored here.
Yeah, we've seen Tim Podlogar Dr. Podlogar pointed us to some of his research, I believe, that showed carbohydrate introduction after 30 minutes of riding without it had no effect on carbohydrate or fat utilization, which is super interesting. And then, I had another point there. Oh, even at super high intensity, maybe at and even above VO2 max, there's still some people who argue that though, minimal, there's still some contribution from fat. It might be a tiny bit, but it never really goes away. And that is still contentious, but it's beside the point anyway. It's such a small contribution. It's never going to impact anything we do realistically. But back on track with the particular fats, these fats are they're trainable. And this is one of the major endurance training adaptations, one of the things we pursue, whether we're aware of it or not. And again, an older study, 1986, Hurley and colleagues used 12 weeks of endurance training to affect the percent of energy derived from fat. And specifically, they had athletes, I think they rode bikes, but I'm not entirely sure, but they worked at 64% of their VO2 max, and fat accounted for 40% of their energy utilization or energy provision. At the beginning of the study, 12 weeks later, 60%. So that's a substantial uptick in how much of their energy actually came from fat and came as a result of training. Then, let's see. Oh, then at even higher percentages of fat. So once we rise above this 65%, fat combustion drops precipitously. And this is due to a number of things. And again, deeper dive might have gone into these things, but one of them is just lack of blood flow. Think about it. I mean, if the blood flow is now being diverted to, cooling, to fueling the muscles, well, not as much is going to the fat, not as much is going to carry free fatty acids out of the adipose tissue and into the bloodstream to be utilized. And then these stores, and whether it's the adipose tissue or the muscle triglycerides, are largely where our energy from fat comes. We're not talking about ingested fat typically. That's a whole other ball of wax. The endurance training actually shifts the supply, and this is, again, the thing I don't think people recognize from the adipose, the adipose contribution, so our fat stores, the visible subcutaneous fat stores that nobody really likes, at least in the endurance community, decreases, and the contribution from the stuff in the muscle, the intramuscular triglycerides, actually increase. And I think this is worth noting because utilization of these muscle triglycerides is mainly in the fast twitch oxidative fibers, so the type 2A fibers, those intermediate ones that we've talked about a number of times. And that's, again, if you're not – well, that's another point. I'll get to it. It also happens in the type 1s, and this is assuming the exercise intensity is kept low enough. But my point here is that as intensity rises, there's a shift from our adipose tissue – or I'm sorry, our adipose fat to our muscle fat. And the same thing with endurance fitness, as it rises, a similar shift occurs. And I think this is probably something valuable for people to keep in mind when they're riding exclusively for fat loss, as we've gotten that question so many times. And if you're looking specifically for adipose loss, it's not to say that when you hit 65%, you're not burning adipose tissue anymore. It's still contributing, but a shift is taking place, especially if you're conditioned. Now it's going to lean a little more towards the fat stores within your muscles, and that does nobody any favors when it comes to concerns over body composition. So, and just an easy benchmark is if that's your goal, go out and work as hard as you want to, as long as you can still breathe through your nose. And you don't have to literally breathe through your nose the whole time, but the pace should be easy enough that you could close your mouth and breathe through your nose for really as long as you wanted to. It has to be that easy.
So to interrupt on that, because we've talked about a different perspective on that too. And if your goal is just to shift body composition, in other words, reduce body fat, we talked about the fact that really, when it comes down to it, it's like calorie deficit is the main thing that changes what if you're going to be losing that. And if you work hard and you train your body to be able to do more work, it's easier to manage those sort of calorie deficits. It's tricky to manage a calorie deficit, and it kind of like bites when you least expect it. Sometimes athletes might do it for one day and be like, I'm good carrying this, 500 calorie deficit or something more. But then over time, it gets really difficult to be able to maintain. But we talked about if you're really like your goal, and I can't remember the episode, but if your goal is to shift body composition, know that, don't diet on the bike, give yourself the fuel you need to be able to do on the bike itself, and focus on being able to do more work. And over time, that's a good sustainable way to be able to shift body composition. So, because I can hear people in their minds go, all right, locking in, never break in zone 2, going to do what Richard's done here. And that's how I'm going to be able to shift my body composition. It's arguable that you might actually be able to shift it more favorably by doing more work, that, higher kilojoules, and then thusly, your body's going to continue to burn fat thereafter as well throughout the workouts. It's probably a better way to do it for a lot of folks. So
yeah, for sure. To lose fat through the long, slow distance method, you have to have a lot of time, the long portion of that. You have to be able to ride for a lot of hours. So you can't go out and just do 2 hours a week at this particular intensity and expect it to work miracles on your body composition. It sadly doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and but there's opportunity cost with that too, right? Because then you're spending that time doing something else that you could be doing, you know.
Yeah, and it could be argued that that's not even the most healthful way to go about pursuing improvements in performance or just, you know, good health.
Great point.
Okay, so it's about the 65% point this shift that's due to the ever rising intensity that for a translation, this is probably in terms of power, in terms of percentage of FTP, probably somewhere around 80% of FTP. So that's kind of the high end of things where you're going to start tipping into where you start to burn the fat in the muscle, and this could be a pretty reasonable break point where carbohydrate intake becomes of greater concern. This is where you really have to make sure you are actually fueling for the work, because fat's just not carrying as heavy a load. And if it is, it's the fat that's in the muscles, and it's going to deplete at some point. Problem is, this is a bit of a moving target, and this is all based on your aerobic and anaerobic capabilities. And again, it's that whole training status variable that I named earlier. And so the difference between conditioned, unconditioned, highly conditioned all plays into this. And then there are also differences in fitness capabilities. Because if you look at this from, and let's just use round numbers, but if you consider an athlete who has a 200 watt FTP versus an athlete who has a 400 watt FTP, if they both ride at 240 watts, they can, you know, weigh the same weight moving up the hill at, well, not on a hill, on a flat road. Either way, they're both working at 240 watts. The 200 watt athlete is at 120% of their FTP, while the 400 watt athlete is at 60% of their FTP. So this is one athlete operating at all the way 100% or near 100% of VO2 max. The other one may be 50% of VO2 max. So clearly, power at VO2 max bears a really strong influence on substrate percentages at all times, right? And that power output can change a little. It can change a lot within an athlete. So from the beginning of the season to mid-season to end of season, you could actually be, in terms of metabolic usage, a very different athlete. But back to the point at hand, we can indeed influence how much work is fueled by these fat stores via endurance training. And that study that I mentioned earlier by Acton and Uchendrup from 2004 remarked on the maximum rates of fat oxidation typically reached. And they pinned it between 47 and 52% of VO2 max in a very large sample of general population, which I take to mean untrained people. Then you look at trained individuals, and that creeps up to 59% to 64%. So basically 50% of VO2 max versus 60% of VO2 max is the difference of roughly, you know, 10 to 12% of VO2 max. First point being is that with training, fat contribution maxes out at higher percentages of your VO2 max. That is, more work is done aerobically, and what does this do but reduce your utilization on your anaerobic energy stores, your much more finite energy stores. So quick review before we move on to actual explanations for Richard's metabolic efficiency panel. First is that both training and diet can move the needle with regards to fuel preference, fuel utilization, and fitness capacity. Whether you want to go fat adapted and work lower and longer, both of these things can affect it. And we're seeing both of these things, I would suspect, in action right now with Richard. And these changes are super, super subjective based on a number of other variables too. So we can't even just whittle it down to those two variables. Those are probably the two biggest. Okay, so now back to Richard's actual question. First, one possibility is the ever-present possibility of overtraining. You simply just can't elevate because you're coming into this tired. You may have all the fuel necessary on board. Your motivation may be in place, but the fact is you've just overreached to a point where you're not going to be able to reach the performance or realize your performance capacity. It's just not on offer.
I had sent this question over to Dr. Podlogar as well, to get his perspective. And right, Chad, that was one of his first things like, is this athlete overtrained? That was one of the first things he wanted to see.
When I read the question too, and I had to, you know, kind of dismiss it because of what Tim pointed out, what you pointed out, and what I saw when I looked at his history is that he's got a lot of successful workout completions. They are at low intensity, so you got to take that with a grain of salt. But I don't think overtraining is the reasoning here. And then The second possibility is dietary, right? Are you avoiding carbohydrate, perhaps favoring fat, whether you're doing this on purpose or, you know, kind of subconsciously? And I'm really curious as to what his LT measurements looked like. Because, and this is from a paper just a few years ago, 2017, Inigo San Milan and George Brooks looked at they used metabolic flexibility via the measurement of blood lactate, fat, and carbohydrate oxidation in response to exercise. And I botched the heck out of that. But basically what they concluded is that blood lactate accumulation is negatively correlated with fat oxidation, positively correlated with carbohydrate oxidation across a wide range of metabolic capabilities. They looked at everyone from professional athletes to amateur athletes, moderately fit, to not even athletes, but people with metabolic syndrome. And they noticed that's just the correlation. And also, back to Dr. Podlogar, he pointed out that pursuing metabolic efficiency testing hints at a concern over your diet and your fat-burning capabilities. So it's clearly on your mind. You know, how much it's impacting your dietary choices is the question I would like to ask. And then finally, my suspicion is that this is simply due to a lack of training on the anaerobic side of things. I think that not only has Richard been going the traditional base route, but he's been repeating phase one, and phase one especially is going to have this effect if this is all you're doing, especially, I mean, just considering the fact that it might be exclusively L2 training, so endurance level training. And think about it. I mean, if your intensity doesn't recruit many of the fibers that metabolize carbohydrate, you're not producing much lactate. And even at your current high end, which is why I wanted to see what your lactate readings are, because I would bet they're really low. All of this points to me answering categorically yes, you can absolutely pull up your FTP with simply increasing your carbohydrate burning capabilities. And this is going to be done via moderate intensity training and high intensity training. And I want to be clear, this can simply mean the addition of moderate intensity training. You can simply move into tempo, do some sweet spot. I mean, that would start to have an impact on his ability to metabolize fuel anaerobically, carbohydrate in particular. But us here at Trainer Road, we're super strong proponents of the inclusion of high intensity interval training. Most coaches are. And it has benefits that range outside of sport performance, first of all. And within the sports performance realm, the benefits range widely. And I do think this is the approach that makes the most sense for someone competing at 70.3 distances, where more fuel availability is going to lead to higher power output over the event, faster finishing times, all due larger to greater metabolic flexibility. Because right now I see Richard as exhibiting pretty low metabolic flexibility. Were his goals ultra distance, and I know it sounds like they eventually are, he wants to do Ironman. This brings to mind the paper that Tim Podlogar linked us to, the Maunder, Kilding, and Plews paper from 2018, where they said basically that it's reasonable to compete a race of this nature on little more than fat, but it's going to be slow. It's going to be greater than 12 hours. And for some people, whether they use carbohydrate or not, 12 hours is not slow, but the more commonly they're going to fall in the 14 to 15 hour range because you simply can't do the work if you don't have the carbohydrate. And even when it comes to top competitors, something this paper pointed out, even at the Ironman distance, they're typically ingesting carbohydrate. Even if they choose to train low, even if they're fat adapted, they're commonly going to rely on carbohydrate in the event itself. And this actually brings us to what Hannah's going to talk about, the gut capabilities, being able to actually handle that sort of influx of carbohydrate into the gut.
Yeah, because that's like, what does this practically look like for you, Hannah? Like training your ability to take in and process and use all the carbohydrate?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've done these metabolic efficiency panels before, and they are really interesting. They provide some great insight. But for me, it's really just a snapshot of where you're at. It's not really something that I'm going to carry with me, you know, year after year after year and base my training off of. It's just a data point along the way that's going to aid in my process of figuring out where I'm at right now. And a lot of that, you know, your body's going to use what you give it. So if you only give yourself 30 grams of carbs an hour, your body's going to use it. That's how it's going to respond. And whatever it needs beyond that, yeah, you run out of carbohydrate stores. So you're going to have to rely on something else. If you give your body more carbohydrates per hour, your body will learn to use it over time. But the key point is it does have to learn. And this is where I think a lot of people get tripped up, is they hear, okay, you know, this many grams of carbs an hour, whatever it might be, whatever is a realistic goal for you at the time. Maybe it's just you're trying to do 80 grams of carbs an hour and you do that on your first ride. There's a very good chance that that's going to be extremely uncomfortable. And if you don't know better, you're going to come home and you're going to say, that doesn't work for me. That's
you're
gonna not.
You're going to say, sorry, Jonathan did this like 7 years ago.
Yeah.
I just have a picky stomach. I just can't do it. Right.
Totally.
Remember that?
Exactly.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, Hannah. Yeah.
Exactly. I hear it all the time. My stomach doesn't work for me. It hurts my stomach. I'm pickier. I need different food. You know, people will go through all different types of food and that's fine. But the point is, it is uncomfortable at first and you have to stay the course. You can't try it one time and then try something else and then try something else and then try something else and think that eventually something's going to click. You have to commit to a process and try it for an extended period of time. And after that extended period of trying, you make small adjustments. If you adjust five things, we don't know which of the five things hurt it. And so you have to stick with what you know, stick with a plan. So for me, my fueling, it's very rare that I'm out there thinking, oh man, I really want another gel, especially when I'm racing. It's like, that's not, you don't crave that typically. And so for me, my fueling is always a plan. I'm always thinking about science over comfort or science over desire.
Oh, it's kind of like really good points.
Imagine if you started cycling and you're like, do 300 watts. You're like, I just can't do it. Just impossible. Yeah. Never going to be able to do it. Can't happen.
Yeah.
And you give up. You're like, this is just not a thing for me. I'm a picky system. Like, I know all you can do 300 watts, but I can't touch it for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
It's training. You got to train your gut, basically. Mm-hmm. You're not adapted to taking those amount of carbs.
And it has to happen like somewhat regularly, right? Hannah, you and I were talking about this before we recorded, but you go through periods of your year where you may not be taking in as much and then other spots where you're taking in a ton. Like for me right now, I haven't been taking in a bunch just because I've been trying to I've been saving money because it gets super expensive if you're taking in like 120 grams an hour, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was just taking around 60 to 80 or so, but I have Tahoe Trail 100 coming up with Ivy and we're doing the team relay. And I'm getting fast for that. So I'm working my way back up. And just this past Saturday, I was at 110 grams an hour. But I went from like 80 to 110, basically. Just like a quick snap. And my gut handled it mostly, but it wasn't perfectly happy afterward. And so it was a good reminder to me that like, oh yeah, I have to ease my way into this. Even though at Cape Epic, 118 grams per hour is what it averaged out to over the entire Cape Epic, right? The whole way through. I had done it before, but I still had to train myself to be able to do it after I had dropped off.
But it's an adaptive process like anything else. You can't just inflict this form of insult. And it is an insult when you go from, you know, riding with 30 grams of carb an hour to anything higher than that, 60, 90, 120. You have to, and I'm sure it comes down to more than this, but one of the major adaptations is the change in enzymatic activity that happens. I mean, if you give your body a ton of fat, it's going to eventually over time increase its lipolytic enzymatic capability. So fat burning enzymes, you douse it with a whole bunch of carbohydrate, glycolytic comes up. If you're heavily on the protein side, proteolytic comes up. It's going to respond to what you dose it with, and it's going to figure out, like Hannah said, how to make energy with that. When that energy is no longer available, it's either going to pull it from somewhere else or it's going to make you go slower. That's really the only two options at that point.
Yeah. In Richard's case, doing all this low intensity training, and Nate, I want to hear your thoughts and on this in just a bit too, but
me
in
too.
Richard's case,
just kidding.
In Richard's case of doing a lot of low intensity training, Richard, if you start working your way in now, once again, like Chad said, we don't know your exact goals with like what you're trying to take in nutrition wise, everything else. And if your goal is to get faster and prep for 70.3s and everything else, I guarantee you, if you just even start with 30 grams an hour, then work your way up, man, you're going to feel so enabled to be able to do more work. It's going to be fantastic. It feels so good. It almost feels like I finally match, like there's a match going on when I can do more work and I can feel that work. And it just feels like I can keep going. It's just fantastic. And I know there's probably folks that are ketogenic that are going to share an example of a sub 12-hour Ironman result, or people that are going to share that, like, hey, for me, it works perfectly, and that's fine. But this is like, absolutely, this is an approach that works. It's exemplified by the pro Peloton. It's exemplified by pro athletes like Hannah that we have with us, and average athletes that are able to achieve really, really good outcomes. If you listen to our Successful Athletes podcast, so many of them, they talk about low volume training is a big thing for a lot of them because it allows them to be consistent. But the other thing is taking in more carbohydrate, and that enabled them to have these situations where they blew past a previous plateau. When you do it, just enables you to do a lot more work, Richard. So don't think you're stuck. There's absolutely, like Chad and Hannah have said, there's great room for improvement, and it's really close and easy to get relatively. Yeah,
and speaking, Richard, don't get hung up on the anecdotes and the outliers, because those are always going to be there. But all they do is really serve to distract us from the point. And the point is what works for most of us. And that's what we're after right here.
Mm-hmm. Nate, let's hear some thoughts.
Let's do it. Okay, Richard, the goal is to put out as many kilojoules per second over time and not have that drop off, right? That's the goal. The goal is not the highest percentage of fat burning. The person who burns the highest percentage of their VO2 max and fat burning does not win, does not have the best times. You could actually improve your percentage of fat burning, percent of VO2 max, and have a lower score if your VO2 max goes down, right? So you could be like, but I'm like, well, I'll just make up some numbers. I meant not possible. 95%. Yeah, but you might be only putting out 120 watts, right? These are not possible things. But I'm just saying, some people put a lot of pride in that percentage. When, if that's your goal, great, like, go for it. But if your goal is to like have a fast half Ironman time, those two, based on research, don't always, probably won't lock up. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to think of too is when you think of the amount of like fat burning, think of the grams of fat per minute that you're burning. And Dr. Poljegar has like cool stuff on this, but if you raise your threshold, right, you can still burn just as much as you had at that high percentage of VO2 max at a lower one. You burn just as many, as much fat per minute, but probably actually even more fat per minute, even if your percentage of VO2 max goes down, because it's the room is bigger. The room is bigger. So you, instead of burning, oh, I forget, I don't even know the relative numbers, but instead of burning a little bit, it could be even more. It could be 20% more, right? And I looked at your career, and you are a 42-year-old, and your FTP is 254, and you're 178 pounds, 81 kilos, which is 3.15 watts per kilo. And looking at your progression levels, I mean, this kind of says it all. Your endurance is 7.5, your tempo is 5.3, your sweet spot is 2.3, and then threshold 1, VO2 max 1.1, anaerobic 1, sprint 1. Not that you need to do sprint, but you've just not been hitting those other zones. And I have your next race I looked is a little over 5 months away, Richard. And I think you're going to have to balance this, because it's going to be a different amount of recovery, but actually might be doing less shorter workouts. But I think, Richard, you can get up to from 254 at 42 up to 300 watts FTP. That puts you at 3.7 watts kg. You are so consistent looking at your career. I think you can do this. And you're going to eat more carbs during this time. And you're going to come into your race, and let's say you do 80% of threshold for a half Ironman. You're pretty fast. I looked at it. You did a pretty fast time, just slightly over 5 hours at Oceanside. If you do that, instead of doing it like 200 watts, you might be able to do it at 240 watts, 40 watts faster at 80%. Like 40 watts faster, once the whole amount of time on the course is going to go down, right? And you could even go, man, if you really want to do a burn a higher percentage of fat, you could still race at that 200 watts. That's another thing that people don't think about. Because you have room, right, on your FTP, is you could be at 254 in racing at 200 watts, or you could be at 300 and racing at 200 watts. And just about
you'll every smash single your run, right? Like
just about like, every single time. Yeah. You're going to be burning more fat you're going to be farther back on that curve about the percentage of fat you're burning at when you have that higher threshold. Mm-hmm. And then you can kind of pick a number inside of that based on training, how you feel, and do some brick runs to see what you run off of that. So even if it did change a little bit and you're like, instead of 80%, I'm going to do it at 78% of FTP, which even those are pretty conservative. You can probably bump it up to 82 or 83, or if you're really fast, 85. Even with that, you can still burn more fat. Like, you can burn more fat. You can have glycogen left over for the run and be a very, very fast athlete. So I want you to be 300 watts FTP and a threshold level of 4.0 by the time that race comes along. Then you can race down. You know, if you feel like you don't you want to burn more fat or you're worried about it, and then also try to get those carbs up to 90, and I think there's going to be some research, or there actually has been research now, right? That's 120 is possible, correct?
Yeah, and there's research that's more coming out. It's exciting. So yeah so
you great. Can go even higher. So yeah. it's about it's not about the percentage of it. It's you're not racing longer than the 5 hours, right? If you're racing 30 hours, we have a different talk, right? Right, Chad?
Yeah.
If you're racing 30 hours in a row, totally different. If you're racing 20 hours, even 15, like 15, we start to be like, it could be a different thing. If you're an ultra, like the ultra Ironman, where it's almost like two Ironmans back to back.
Yeah.
That's a different thing too. But most of us don't do that, right? Most of us don't do that at all.
Can I use like a really simple analogy that we're probably, most folks are familiar with, is like a hybrid car. Imagine doing the Indy 500 with a hybrid car and being like, I used only the small hybrid motor, not the gas motor whatsoever the whole way through. Like, look at me, what a great achievement. But because of that, you won't have crossed the line even remotely close to first, right? The goal isn't to use a hybrid, you know, the hybrid little battery motor instead of the gas motor that you have. Like, gas motor is going to give you a whole lot of speed. And that's the same thing. When you can process a bunch of carbohydrate like this and your body can use it, man, you go fast. So yeah, good stuff for you, Richard. Stefan's question says, how do you execute the perfect neutral feed? How can you set up the feed zone if you have no support? What or where is the correct way to hold out a bottle? And what is the correct way to grab it so that it doesn't fly out of your hand onto the road? I see the pros taping gels to bottles, and is there a best way to tape them? Or do you just avoid a single bottle hand up and just do a musette bag? Love the podcast. Let's deep dive on this. So just, maybe one or two questions in there. there's a lot of them. So Hannah, it seems like Stefan's asking about road feed zones, but there's principles that can go across, and we can probably talk about the context of mountain bike stuff too, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of questions here, and I feel like it spans a lot of different things. A true neutral feed, and then he asks about no support, but then he asks about how to hold out a bottle. So if you're getting true neutral support, you're probably not going to have an option of taping gels to the bottles or how to hold them out. So I'll address both sides of the coin, and I think across the span of racing, mountain bike, gravel, road, feed zones do vary a lot. So I think the first point when going into a race is to actually learn what the feed zone situation is going to be. You should read it online. You should inquire at the site. You should talk to people who've done the race, because the difference between those three things will all vary. What it says online might not be a ton of information. What someone experiences in the race will probably be the best information. Sometimes feed zones are packed. Sometimes there's a huge spread of stuff. Sometimes not so much. Maybe it's a really long race and you're going to be the only one at this feed zone at a certain time. So there's a big span in what to expect. I think if you do have support, the first thing is communicating with them about exactly what you want. It is a really stressful situation when you come into the feed zone. If you're in a group, if you're going for a time, everyone's emotions are elevated. So you need to have a plan. And I recommend that you text your person the plan or write it down for them. This can feel like overkill in the moment, but I've never regretted it. so many times, okay, the blue bottles are mix, the clear bottles are water. I want one of each at each speed zone. And then you roll up and the person's holding both blue bottles and you're just like, why would you do this to me? Are you trying to ruin my race? Like, no, they're not. They're doing their absolute best, but they just forgot because when you told them it was 5 hours ago. So that's why I think it's really nice to write these things down for people. Sometimes
you should write down, make sure they're cold because if they're like super hot and a Leadville, just like a
Chad and I don't like know what
slightly
you're
boiling
about.
Simmering. I would like my Martin simmering, please.
It was a light rolling boil. Yeah. We took it right off the kettle for you, Nate. I don't know what you're complaining about. So. But Hannah, this is a good point because when you go in to the feed zone, you should anticipate that you have like lower ability to focus, lower ability to communicate. It's like it's just anticipating needs that are going to exist in the moment rather than right then at that same time that you're informing people. That's a really good like principle of preparing, is to anticipate the conditions that you're going to be in rather than just, you know, thinking it, you know, just literally writing it down.
Hannah, what you say, I resonates to me so much. So I want to jump in because I agree with everything you're saying, but I saw on Ryan Standish's, Unbound, he had a view and support people, listen to your person who's exhausted. Cause Ryan came up and, he came to and I don't know the backstory. This is just what I saw in an Instagram story, but he goes, two pumps, rear tire. And what they proceeded to do is get a different wheel to change it out. And it can be so hard to communicate those things. Like you don't want to explain everything when you're that tired and be like, no, actually it just burped a little bit. There's no gash with it. I just need two extra pumps, or I want the different rolling resistance, or the course is going to change. Two pumps for your tire. And they kept like trying to change his wheel out. And just give him two pumps and let him go. It was frustrating for me to watch it. I don't know what happened in the end of that story. Maybe he did need a better wheel, and maybe his pit crew actually were smarter than him right at that time. His mechanics could have been totally possible. They could have seen something else. But if you're a support person, sometimes you just say something really quick, like water, get water right away. Lube, get lube. Don't be like, what kind of lube, or what, you know, as Hannah said, decide all those things ahead of time.
Yeah. And communicate them. Like, I think it goes both ways. I love what Nate's saying, in that if I come into the feed zone and I ask for water, but I specifically told you mix, it's probably because something's happening and now I want water. So it's okay to change. I also think sometimes you give someone else the plan because in the moment when everything's hectic, you as an athlete forget the plan or think that you no longer need it. I know I've come into a feed zone with a group and my support's trying to hand me food and I'm just like, I don't need food. I need to be in the pack. It's like, I'm pretty sure you should take the extra 5 seconds to put this food in your pocket. And that's where, you know, it does kind of span a spectrum. And that's where just having the communication and knowing the person you're working with, and even sharing a little bit of insight into your personality and saying, hey, when I come into the feed zone, I'm going to be stressed. My voice will probably be raised, but you're doing a great job. So, you know, just communicating that is important and totally fair.
Yeah. I can't afford Chad to do this, but I want to be able to pay Chad to be my support person at every single race. It's amazing. So I think you all know of the gravitas that Chad has, his calm that he communicates as well, everything else. But sorry, Chad, making you blush. But at Leadville, when he was crewing for me, it was like, and I tend to be on the more high energy side of things, right? And I came into, anytime I saw Chad, it was like an oasis of calm. He just like... saw me. He was smiling. He was complimentary, but he wasn't over the
just
top.
Just bored. And he was slightly buzzed.
Could have been that.
Just kidding.
But neither, actually. It was like a great energy match, right? He was giving me what I needed, and that was calm and confidence, right, in the moment. And there's a lot to be said for that. I'm not sure I've ever really provided that for Nate in his feeds or anything else. I get really excited and support, but
it might not be a good match for Nate. Matching. I mean, you and I, as you pointed out, I was a good match for you, but in other people's cases, I can't really muster huge enthusiasm. So I might be exactly what they don't need. They might need someone who is a little more flamboyant and up and, you know, motivating.
Yeah. Yeah. Really positive. It was great. It was like what I need. So, and I know we don't always have that luxury. You may be listening to this and you may just hopefully find another like spectator and be like, can you hand me a bottle here? And that's the best that you can do. So we're just talking, and that's okay. We're just talking about if you have the opportunity to, there's subtle things about how you carry yourself in that feed zone that can really help an athlete. If you know they're going to be stressed, anticipate that with calm. If you know they're going to need encouragement and motivation, be ready to give it.
And on the flip side of that, volunteers and people doing support, it can be – so on the short races, I have this thing when I was running in triathlons that if I talked while I was running, I would give myself a side ache. So I had to really keep my breathing in line with my steps, and it was really hard to talk, especially in like an Olympic or a sprint. And I would love to say thank you to every aid station person. And to kind of like put my hand and like shake my head, yes. But people are in sometimes the most pain of – maybe some of the top experiences and painful and hardest experience of their life doing these endurance events. So if they come up and they are, it could be easy to come off as not appreciative. Mm. So also as the athlete before and after the race, you know, let them know, be like, hey, I'm going to be in the pain box. I might not look at you. I'm not going to smile and I might not talk. And that's not because I'm not appreciate your support. That's because I am an inner battle of my emotions and will are happening right now. And I need to just, keep my head in the game, which is, you know, I think we've all been there, right? It is very hard to do, to even talk to somebody.
I look mean whenever I race. Apologies in advance to everybody. So yeah, that's just how it goes. Hannah, what other tips? They were talking about holding the bottle too. And I have I've had a wide range of experiences with folks holding bottles.
Yeah, I think if you're holding a bottle, you should be holding the top of the bottle with your hand over the mouthpiece on the top so that the entire body of the bottle is available for grabbing. If your hand is on the body of the bottle, the chances of you hitting hands or not having a place for the athlete to grab that bottle is really increased. So having your hand over the top so that the entire bottle is available, I think across the board, is the best way to do it. I also think you should always feed so that the athlete's grabbing with their right hand. Maybe that varies if someone's left-handed, but in most cases, that's where feed zones are. So it's just best that that's how we all practice and all train. Like in World Cups, you don't have an option. You always feed so that the athlete's grabbing with the right hand. And so if we all just commit to that, I think that's the best case scenario as well, because then there's less mess also of people trying to go to different sides of the feed zone and crossing wheels and things like that.
Yeah, good tips.
Another pro tip, is volunteers or support people, if the rider is tall, put it up pretty high and you're short. I've totally had it where I'm like trying to reach down at like below my my top tube height. It's very hard. And also riders, slow down. Like I know you think you're going to grab this bottle at 20 miles per hour. One, it's dangerous for, like I'm talking to triathletes specifically, it's dangerous for those volunteers. And oftentimes too, some of these volunteers, they know there's like usually a line they should not cross. So many times they will. And the little bit of time that you slow down, one, having the bottle is going to make you go faster, right? In this race, that's why you want it. And it's very easy to miss it. And stopping is even slower. But two, some people just jump out. I've seen it where they drop a bottle and they see a bottle in front of them and they get like laser focused on that and they want to jump out. Get out of your error bars. Like, I know it seems like, of course you get out of your error bars and feed. No, no, no. Some people are like, I don't want to reduce my,
they're also laser focused. Yeah. Exactly. They're laser focused in the other way.
Mm-hmm. Slow down. Think of it as a great way to stretch your back a little bit, stretch your neck, to coast a little bit and grab that bottle and be safe during it. Have one hand on the brake so that if somebody does dart out, both of you aren't going to have a race that's over. This has even happened to pros. Pro athletes at races, a volunteer takes a step out, right? And it can be so hard. And a lot of times too, pros, the race, very little time does in a triathlon, half or full Ironman, does it come down to 3 or 4 seconds, right? Mm-hmm. Usually it's, there's a couple famous ones that have done it, but in general, they're usually bigger gaps, right? Where this slowing down for everyone to be safe, it's going to be okay.
A couple tips on feed zone stuff with bottles. Like Hannah said, just communicate beforehand on which side you're going to grab the bottles. Make sure that's communicated. Big thing. When you hold a bottle on the bottom, it's tempting for a lot of people to hold the bottom of the bottle. Think about when the hand grabs it, it's naturally tipping the bottle over. Whereas if the bottle is hanging from the person's hand, it can swing and go with the rider. So it's not just like a single impact, but that bottle can stay with the hand for, you know, fractions of a second that makes it a whole lot easier to grab. The other side of this too is do not, as a feed zone person, do not move the bottle when you go to grab it. Hold it like consistent. So then the athlete that's moving can just have a single stationary target to go with. I know it's tempting to want to kind of like go with them and lead them a bit, but then they end up having to recalculate and move their hand around to try to grab it. And it's just tricky. So if you hold your arm, the bottle in one specific position, and then that way the athlete, when they grab it, once they've made contact, you can kind of let your arm go with them a bit and that'll make it a little bit easier, but don't move it beforehand. That's a huge thing.
That's a good point. Do y'all do it where like you kind of try to grab in front and then as you grab it, you like kind of swing your arm back with it. So yes. It makes it so that there's not as big of a change in like an acceleration of the bottle. Yeah. Correct. And you see pros do this all the time too, right? In the Tour de France and stuff, they're like whoosh with their arm.
Yeah. The other side of it too is communicate where you're going to be in the feed zone or where you want your crew to be in the feed zone. Sometimes they're crazy. Like at Leadville, those feed zones would last for like 30 seconds to a minute of like pedaling fast through them. And that's a really long time. And if you're wondering where they're going to be, it's tough. I remember telling Chad beginning of the feed zone at all of them. And Chad was right there at the front of the feed zone. And that made it really easy for me to know where to look. Sometimes it can be really tricky. Also, I tend to prefer the beginning of the feed zone if possible, because then that allows you to, if you do make a mistake or anything else, you aren't out of the feed zone. You can stop and it's kind of like a safe area, because if you're at the very end, let's say you miss a bottle, you stop and you turn around, being out of the feed zone, I know that practically speaking, hopefully you can still be done safely, but being out of the feed zone, you shouldn't be turning around in the middle of the course and going backwards or doing anything like that. But in the feed zone, people will expect riders to be stopped or they'll expect changes. So it just makes it a whole lot easier if you try to stack toward the front. And I know saying this, you know, if we have hundreds of thousands of people that are now, I'm going to go to the front of the feed zone, we have an issue, but it's worth trying for sure.
And there's neutral support usually in the middle. So if you do like, I mean, honestly, at Leadville, you drop your bottle, stop the 3 seconds, pick it up.
Yes.
But in general, I'm going to tell a story. Okay. So I'm going through an aid station. I just not got two bottles, and it's because I didn't grab it well enough. And also the moving target, right? They always want to move it. And I finally get a Gatorade. It's a fruit punch Gatorade, the kind that tastes like Jolly Ranchers, you know, and it's in a sports bottle. This is a half Ironman. We are 1 hour away from the run. It's been very hot and windy. The last section's a headwind. For me, getting that liquid in before the run is very important because it's way harder to get the liquid in on the run than before. So I get this bottle, put it between the bars, get up to speed again, go to take a drink, nothing. And what happened is I can still picture this guy. He's like 17, blonde high school kid who gave me this bottle, not take the plastic inside off.
He knows his address.
Of the bottle. You know, that little like that little safety tinfoil thing?
Yeah.
Not there. So I pull over, do it, put it back on. Okay, I'm going. That's not so big. Finish the race and age group starts, right? I have a friend, Casey Keene. We went back and forth a lot. He started in a different wave than me. He beat me by 15 seconds. I had no clue inside of this. And I'm like, I made a lot of other mistakes where I could have brought 15 seconds up. And this is, talk about extreme ownership. How many times in our lives, I probably had 50, 60, 15 second mistakes or things that I could have done. Sure. What I concentrate on? Oh, it's that other guy's fault, right? Yeah. Who didn't do that. Where if I would have like not touched my brakes in this one spot, I even like dropped my chain, I think on a downhill and had to like get it out. That's my fault. I did not tune my bike well enough, right? I did not go to the right mechanic, that sort of thing. It's so easy in a race to put external blame on someone who's there to help you, especially a volunteer for free or someone used their whole day to do that. When you think about extreme ownership, what could you do? Like Hannah said, Hannah's like, you got to be very specific what you want. You got to communicate all this. Like, you're the athlete, you're the leader of this group. So if they don't do a good job for you, it's your fault. It's not their fault. Like with John, if I was, I would make fun of Leadville, but if I was very specific in, okay, I want to make sure I have half a bag of ice in there, guaranteed that would have been enough direction where John would have made that happen at that aid station. Like, he would have been on his mind and that sort of thing. And that would have been an easy thing for me to say, but I didn't say it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For what it's worth.
It's way more fun to make fun of you.
Chad had all my bottles and hydration packs very icy, by the way. So,
yeah, well, you learn, right?
Yeah, he learned. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Awesome. I want to talk please, Hannah.
I also think we should address the neutral feed since he talked about when you don't have support. And so, in my experience, there's two different types of neutral feeds. There's the type of neutral feed where, for example, at Breck Epic, you get a bag and you give the volunteers the bag, and then that bag is just sitting there for you. And then there's the neutral feed where it's just a free-for-all and whatever is there is all that you get. So in the neutral feed where you get to pick what you have, it's just as if you have a person for you, but that bag is your person. So it needs to be very specific. So the way I like to do that is loose in the bag is everything that I am for sure taking. So my bottle and whatever nutrition I need. So that when I get up to that bag, I'm grabbing everything I'm putting in my pockets. Then inside the bag, I'll have a separate bag of emergency things. So if I think I might need a jacket, if I think I might want some different type of nutrition, if I maybe extra nutrition in case I drop something, that's all going to be in a separate bag that I'm probably not going to touch, but it's there in case I need it. And it's not mixing in with my other stuff. So I'm having to sort through it when I get there.
That's so cool.
Go ahead. Yeah.
That's a great tip. I just want to say that's a great tip.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. And then the other thing is when it's a free-for-all, when you don't get to supply anything, there's not a lot that you can do other than just know and ask as many questions as you can about what you're going to encounter when you're there. Are there going to be bottles that you can take, or are you going to be filling up a bottle? Because that might impact whether you're filling up a bottle or whether you choose a hydration pack, because one is easier than the other to fill up. Also, what kind of food will they have? Because at least for me, I'm allergic to a lot of things. So I have come up to aid stations before and literally had nothing that I could take. So it's important to know what will be there and make an alternative plan if it's not going to work for you.
That is so much extra. Like, I didn't thought of that. The cognitive load of being like, I could go into shock and like, you know, need my EpiPen at this aid station. That's a whole nother level of stress, especially when people are handing you stuff. For an Ironman, my first Ironman, I did not pay attention enough. And I was like, what is special needs? I did not know. And usually what they have is that around mile 70, they have that bag. And that's such a cool tip of like separating the two things and having that, we've talked about it before, but not only the emergency stuff, but what is your go-to, like, if you are just in the worst shape possible. Some people do like, I just want a Red Bull. Or normally you wouldn't drink Red Bulls during it, but in that case, what brightens your day? What is the piece of food? Some people are like peanut butter and jelly sandwich, because there could be a state where I am so tired of sugar in the sweet that I want something very savory, and you put that in there. John, it might be like a little rice cake, right? A bacon rice cake thing that he puts in there for emergency.
Maybe not. I had rice cakes and Red Bull at Leadville in reserve for Chad, for me. Didn't end up using them, but I was super glad they were there, you know?
Just in case.
Yeah. One other point with neutral feed is I feel like if you know that you're going to have to take neutral feed and you don't know much about it, you need to take it upon yourself as an athlete to think about how that interaction is going to go beforehand. I'm thinking of Cape Epic and Stage 1. My chain was just terrible. It sounded like the metal was falling apart back there because we had gone through so many rivers and stuff. And I got to the neutral feed zone thinking that, yeah, they'll have lube for my chain. I'll just pull over and they'll just take care of it for me. And I got there. They went to go put the squirt onto my cassette, the squirt chain lube, and it didn't work. So the guy just rips the cap off and goes to dump the entire bottle on. And I had an out of body experience of where I was just shrieked. I was like, don't do it, and grab my bike. But I realized in that moment that I still feel bad because it was a true shriek of fear, but I bet that it came across as being mean to that person. And I really regret that. I wish that I would have stopped and said, hey, you know what? I'm sorry. That sounded really mean. I shouldn't have reacted that way. And it probably would have cost me like 3 seconds and it wouldn't have mattered in the overall, but I didn't do it. So thinking back, and it wasn't ill-intentioned, but it doesn't matter what your intentions are. The outcome is what matters. So I just really appreciate volunteers and your support crew and everything else that are there at a race and doing so much for you. So it's worth thinking ahead when something is out of your control and you're anticipating that it might go like it's unexpected. Choose your actions beforehand. I know this is probably getting a bit far away from it, but I just feel it's a personal responsibility thing.
I'm going to go farther. So I was just in this weekend course at the – or not – yeah, week course at the MIT Endicott House. It sounds like it's associated with MIT. It is not. It is part of Entrepreneurs Organization, and I'm part of this 3-year program called the Entrepreneurs Master's Program. So EO has 14,000 people, and this class that you're with for 3 years has 60 people. And you come in and you start from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. at night every day, which is exhausting, and you have 3-hour speakers going through, and they're like fantastic speakers. If you've ever read Simon Sinek's Birthing of Giants, he talks about that. That's that course at that place. They've changed names and stuff, and now it's something about Titans or a longer course. Anyways, inside of this one, we had one speaker, and she has a book. I forget her name. If anyone asks, hopefully I'm in the live chat, I can tell you. Talk about being in the red zone and how people, employees, anyone, relationships, if like the amount of stress you are is between 1 through 10, if you're 8, 9, 10, you're no longer logical. You're no longer yourself, and you don't respond to stimulus or stress the same way you would in other states. And maybe in the middle, in that yellow area, you might be able to hold stuff back, but you're still not operating that well. And the idea is in relationships and employees and everything, how can you get people down to that 1, 2, 3? Because then when you have stress, you're like a great person. You're following your core values. You interact with people the way that you want yourself to interact with them, right? And you're capable of. Mm-hmm. So my point on this is when you're racing, oftentimes you're in that 8, 9, 10. And we said before, you're not your true self. So also, Jonathan, I would forgive yourself because it is a very stressful situation to be like that and have 4 more hours of racing. I remember that first aid station. After that, I hit my head right after that. It was a lot of river crossings, but it is total normal. Again, if you're a support person, everyone seems like a jerk sometimes if they're in that red zone. And I'm sure we've all done it, right? Y'all been in that 8, 9, 10?
Totally.
And oftentimes too, in relationships and as a boss, and I've done this myself and I really want to improve on it. You can say 100 things great for 100 days. John actually talked about this too. You say one sentence out of 100 days that's in that red zone. Boy, that sentence focused on, right? You think you've all had it in relationships, everything. And
totally.
The idea is to be aware when you're in that and just, you know, do some calming and even to have to take a break in that situation to get out of that zone.
You know who is
sometimes it's just as simple as communicating that as well. I know sometimes before a race, someone will come up to me and I'll be thinking, I have to tell them this and I don't have the ability to say it the way that I should. And so I'll just start and I'll simply say that. I'm really stressed right now. I'm super nervous about the race. I don't know how to say this any better, but I need you to do this and I need you to do it now. And usually that person understands, you know, they get, oh yeah, no problem. And then after the race, when it's calm, you can go back and say, hey, thanks so much for meeting me where I was at. And that's perfect.
I know, like you've heard me do this for years. I have pre-warned everyone when you talk to John before a race, because people like to talk to us before a race. I'm super happy. I'll talk to you all the way up the gun in the race. I'll talk. Like, until it's like one lap to go, I'll be talking. John, before the race, like, I'm like, what did I, why are you so mad at me? What did I do? Like, I don't want to talk to him and I know him. And I'm always afraid that like some, you know, some listener or trainer or athlete would come up and be like, hey, John. And he just like looks at them and they just like cower and walk away. But he's in that zone and he's in that mindset. So that's why we've said that many times before. Yeah, it's totally. Not the same John at all. We're after the race.
Yeah.
He's super happy.
Happy to chat. You know, who's a great example of this is Nino Schurter. He, forgive me, I've had other athletes too, but he's just like a prominent example of this. I think because for years he just got flats, it seems like at every race. But he just recently got that flat, and we talked about this on the podcast at Nova Mesto after, like, he was right there. He could have gotten a win that would have given him the all-time win record. So talk about being in the red, right? Like, Tom Pidcock was there, and he was not doing well, and Nino smelt blood, and you could see it. And he could have won that day, and then he got a flat. And he rode half a lap on that flat. And when he got to his pit, he did not tell anybody, yell at anybody, tell anybody anything. He hopped off his bike. He grabbed a bottle. He drank it. His team had another bottle for him. He was drinking that bottle. He even patted his team on their back. Like, thanks, guys. This is great. And then he just got back on the bike. The guy just lost the chance. Maybe the only chance he had. I don't know. It could have been the only chance he had to have the most wins in the world ever. And he was as calm as he could be. He was out of red. He was even like out of yellow. He saw that opportunity as a chance to be like, when I'm racing, I'm red. I'm going to go green for a bit. It's going to help me. It's that sort of psychology in a feed zone, I feel like, can go really far for us. It can help us reset and kind of rebuild for the rest of the race.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but Nino's known as like a classy athlete, correct?
Yeah.
A great person. And if you're a leader or in relationships and people know it's a very stressful situation, but you are acting calm, man, do people want to look and lead and be with you more often in that? Mm-hmm. And then you can actually help regulate everyone else's nervous system gets regulated down too. Is if you are the leader and you're calm in that situation, guaranteed if Nino came in was like screaming, the mechanic would have been freaked out, would have been harder probably to do things. But by being calm, things probably got done a little bit faster at that same time. And it's very, very hard to do. I actually, my blood pressure, like I was kind of like, oh my gosh, you know, like I could feel for him right in that situation. Hannah, could you feel that too? Like,
I was there watching him and I remember just like my heart sinking when I saw what was happening. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk about taping the gels because that's something that you can really mess up. I remember doing that at one race and I didn't do it right. And I went to yank the gel and I yanked the bottle out of my cage and it dropped.
Okay, I'm glad I'm
and then
the
I squeezed
one.
All the gel out too. So I had a gel wrapper after everything. It was really bad.
I was worried we were going to move on and I was going to say, we have to address this because I've made this mistake and I don't want other people to make it. So yeah, taping the gel on the bottle, it can be a great trick, but you have to do it right because it can go so, so wrong. You have to tape the gel at its perforation so that it's right on that, so that the tape is acting to help you pull it off. It's a one-handed maneuver where your bottle is in the bottle cage and you're just using one hand to rip the gel off. If you tape the gel slightly below that perforation or too high, if it's too high, you're going to rip the whole gel off the bottle. It might fly out of your hand. It's not going to pull off. If you tape it too low, you might have to stop and literally untape it because you're not going to be able to rip the gel in the middle of the packaging. So it has to be right on that perforation. The other thing is you have to be really careful about where you place it on the bottle, because I've done this too, where you tape it to the bottle, then you go to shove it in your cage and that gel is in the way and it's pushed up or pushed to the side or just comes off or you can't get it in the cage. So make sure with your specific cage, usually it's taping it higher up on towards the mouth of the bottle or the lid, the lid of the bottle. Because if you tape it too low, it's going to get in the way and it's not going to fit and you're going to be fussing with it for way too long.
I pre-tape mine to the lid. Just around that lid. I used to use electrical tape, but I found electrical tape when it was hot would get stretchy. So sometimes when you go to pull it, it would stretch and then it would create a mess. So instead I just use a tiny bit of duct tape and I just wrap that around and I use black because I'm vain and I don't want the silver look, but I use that a tiny bit and I tape that around the top and I actually even pre-cut my gels, not a lot, but just a little bit to make it really easy. The other thing you have to think of, right, Hannah, is your bottle cage. some bottle cages just are not going to accommodate the room for your gel because some of them are shaped kind of weird. So make sure you practice this beforehand and you know where to put your bottle in. If you have a side loading cage, it can be kind of complicated to get one in if you have like a bunch of gels hanging off. So it's definitely something you want to practice beforehand. The one thing that can be said when you add on the gel, you could just carry the gels in your pocket and they probably don't weigh a whole lot depending on how long the race is. Especially if you're doing like cross country Olympic, and it's probably safer to do that. But the one thing that I like about the gels is if you have a hard time remembering to eat the gels, it's going to be really annoying to have a gel flapping and hanging off of your bottle, and you're going to want to rip that off and eat it. So we've talked about setting reminders on the on your Garmin or doing anything like that. This is a good opportunity to also to think of just another reason to force yourself to eat. We should probably talk about the Musette bag because I wonder if Musette bags are going to go away even in road to a certain extent. I think that if you look at it, Team Jumbo-Visma this year in the Dauphiné, I believe, Chad, I don't know if you were watching this too, but they weren't even using Musette bags. They were just going through the feed zones and they just had a bottle with gels taped onto it and that was it. And they're just getting their calories through bottles and gels or through their mix and their gels. And that's it. They're not doing anything else. Cause Musette bags, especially for amateurs, Chad, I don't know if it was the year that we were supporting Nate. I remember seeing multiple crashes in Leadville feed zones because of people handing out Musette bags and getting caught on levers and bars.
Yeah. I watched
and it happens
hard
Peloton too.
Hard crashes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And usually you only have one hand on the bars, right? So it's very easy. Something gets hooked. Oof, you're down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the Musette bag is just when there's a lot of stuff and if you're not supporting other athletes, so you're not on a road team, you probably don't have that much stuff that you can't just grab it all. Also important, if you take in the Musette bag, not necessarily, but you're probably going to need to at some point take both hands off the bars to hold the bag and reach into the bag. And not everyone should be doing that in a race scenario. If you're off-road, it's just inconvenient, period, even if you're on a fire road because you might hit a pothole or a bump that you're unaware of. If it's on the road, yeah, it's definitely possible. But in a Peloton with other people, if you're not a professional, it's just an unnecessary risk, in my opinion.
Agreed.
I have an idea.
Yes, Nate.
Okay, what you do... So I use 3M paper tape to tape my mouth every night because I use a CPAP and it just shoots out of my mouth. And what I do on the side is if the thing turns off in the middle of the night, you suddenly choke because your mouth is taped and the thing is like hooked to my nose and I can't breathe. So I put these little flaps on the edges so I can rip it off really fast. And sometimes I've done that so fast where I'll have like torn skin and you can see it on some of the podcast recordings where it was that morning that it happened. But what if you did that where you... 3M paper tape, it's very terrible and easy, but it's also very sticky. You put the little tabs on and they just tape up like four or five gels together like it's a little bottle, right? And then you can rip it off or you could actually tear with your finger very easily inside your pocket. You could even just have a thing as, you know, you if you squeeze it all and you just rip off one thing at a time, you could probably just squeeze that whole thing and that will then come out into your mouth. And you have like a little thing that goes down into a big wrapper. Also, by having it taped together, I bet you too would be less likely to litter because it's all taped together as one unit. And you'd probably get 6-7 gels in that little thing pretty easily to grab rather than have a bag. If you really need a lot of stuff and you don't like drinking a whole bottle, you want to have water in one or sports drink and then all your other carbs and gels. I like this idea.
You can also do a flask.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I have some of those flasks. Better. Can be super helpful. Yeah.
I have one bottle tip.
Chad, please.
Yeah, hey, fair amount here. Of experience. Yeah. but most of the races I did had neutral feeds, and it was just random people out there with water bottles. And that was it. There wasn't mixed. It was just water bottles. And I think this carries for a lot of running races, definitely carry for duathlons, but it's just people holding little doses of water for you. And I found it really helpful if I would point to the person from whom I'm going to take my bottle or my cup or whatever it is, make eye contact with them, point at them. They know it's me. And it seriously establish that connection. And they're not looking for the next person to give it to, which is often why people miss that exchange, is they've moved on. That person thinks, oh, not taking it from me. They're looking at the next rider down the line, and you reach for it. It's not where it was, and it all goes upside down. So just point at them.
Great. Great tip. Yeah. Like it. Let's do one more question. Hannah, did you have something else on this one? Sorry.
No, I just think that's a great tip. I've been accused of like having an arm like a frog's tongue, like when I grab something. So and sometimes people think that I'm not going to grab it. So I think that's a really good tip, is either have your hand out, or the eye contact and the pointing is even better.
Eye contact doesn't usually work because you have glasses that are mirrored, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. you can't really tell where you're looking. But that point of like you, and they're like, you both shake your head, and then you're exactly. like, okay, this exactly. is it. You're my
imagine person. Imagine having fast Coach Chad pointing at you in the feed zone back in the day. My goodness, that would have been powerful, right?
Yeah. The whole world like centers yeah, just exactly. Chad. Everything else yeah. blankets out.
Oh my God, it's don't slow blow, motion. Don't blow it.
Forget the Uncle Sam poster. That would be like, you know. Let's go to last question from Becca. We're going to skip the cadence one. We'll cover that in a coming week, but we're already going long. So I just want to get into Becca's question though, because Hannah, we got you. This one's specifically for you. She says, hi, host. While following Hannah on Instagram last week, which y'all can do, by the way, give Hannah a follow. Give all of us a follow. It'd be great to see you all in there. She says, I saw what looked like horrific conditions at the Missoula XC race. The mud was slimy, hills were steep, and it looked cold. Next time she's on, can you ask her what she does for technique in mud to stay, and these four specific things, to stay upright on climbs, steep descents, off cambers, and ruts? Hannah, what tips do you have?
Yeah, it's riding in mud is definitely a learned skill, because a lot of it is feeling, which is really hard, especially depending on where you live, because not everywhere do you have the opportunity to go out and ride in mud. A lot of places it's actually not okay or even frowned upon. So that's where I think sometimes experiencing these races is worth so, so much. Because for some people, it's the only opportunity they have to learn. So first of all, don't be hard on yourself if you're in your first mud race, just wondering why you can't seem to ride it like other people. There are definitely certain learned techniques that it just takes time. The first thing that before the race is having the proper tires. That can make a world of difference. You want to look for something that is going to grab the mud, probably with some bigger lugs, but also cut through the mud. So sometimes even a narrower tire can do pretty well because it's cutting through the mud. Also, spaced apart lugs, because you don't want the mud to be picking up. And then if you're picking up the mud, eventually it's going to cover all those lugs or fill in the space in between. And then you don't have any traction. So yeah. Yeah. Looking for a tire that's going to fit all of those needs is really important before the race. Yeah.
What tires do you use, Hannah? Like in muddy conditions, what would be your ideal compared to the dry?
Yeah, for really muddy conditions, I love the Kenda Karma. It's really spaced apart lugs, and they're pretty big. At Missoula, I actually used the Rush, though, because I felt like while it was muddy, I didn't need as big of lugs. I just needed it to be able to shed the mud. And so it's still that tire still worked really well for me.
Nice.
Yeah. So after you pick your tire and you're out there, first thing, don't question it anymore, because you're already out there. I know that it seems very simple, but I know people will spend the whole race wondering if they're on the right equipment. It's too late.
Good point.
So just assume you are and move on. For the climbs, I think a really big thing is weighting your tires or wheels evenly, because if you don't have enough pressure, that it's going to spin out. So if you're trying to climb, leaning all of your weight over the front wheel, that back one's going to slide. And if you have too much and you're just sitting down and you're in a really hard gear and you're mashing, you're going to spin. And so it's finding this perfect balance where you're weighting both wheels evenly and you're applying even pressure up the whole climb. So sometimes, for example, in the Missoula short track, typically I would stand and climb up that 15 to 20 second hill out of the saddle every lap, since it was muddy, I stayed seated most all of the race because I knew I needed to maintain that pressure on both of the wheels. Mm. For the descents, I think it's a lot about controlling speed. So actually in Canmore, it had rained the night before. So in our race, while it wasn't muddy, it was really, really slick. It was kind of an icy sort of sensation with the mud or dirt. And so for that, it was really important to not lock out the wheels and to not brake in the middle of some of these technical descents. So that meant there were some switchbacks and then some steep chutes. And the chutes, once you got into it, it was just so muddy that if you locked up those brakes, you were going to lose all of your traction and you were just going to fishtail down it with no control. And so for me, in those corners, I was coming to a very, very slow speed using all of my brakes because they were flatter in the corners. And then the chute would angle down and get really steep. And I would enter that really slow and then let go of the brakes pretty much entirely so that I had as much traction as possible by using the rolling of the tires to maintain that traction. And then for off cambers and ruts, I mean, there are certain techniques, but I feel like it's so specific to exactly what it is. Where is the rut? How big is it? Can you ride on the side of it? Can you ride all the way in it, you know, in the off camber? So for those type of obstacles, my suggestion in the mud is usually do what works and don't think about style points. So if that means unclipping a foot and having it out, like you see in cyclocross all the time, that's what's fast is fast. It doesn't matter what it looks. It doesn't matter if you dab in a race. There's no points for I never touched the ground. Well, you didn't win. So, you know, it's whatever makes you feel the safest and the fastest. So sometimes even in the mud, that's running. And that's great. It's a perfectly fine option. So it's experimenting with all of the different options in those type of scenarios.
I never ride in mud because I don't have to. I'm not paid to race in mud. And we rarely have mud here when it does rain. Seems like you just can't even ride in it just because your bike gets stuck. The one thing that I find, so because of motocross my whole life, not having traction is comfortable to me because you kind of never have traction on a dirt bike. Your wheels are always moving. You know, they're never just like tracking perfectly. But that's the tricky part with mud for me is I'm always trying to be like, I almost get more worried when I have traction. I just want to start losing traction because then my body goes into this like natural state of knowing what to do. But it's that fear of losing track or fear of having traction and when am I going to lose it that kind of throws me off. One of the things that I've found, at least on off cambers, is starting high. And what I mean by that is if there's an off camber coming up, give yourself as much room as possible to work with. You have unpredictability ahead of you. You might slide at any point. And if you start at the bottom and you start sliding, you might go off course. If you start up high on the off camber and then start letting yourself drift down, you have some wiggle room and you can catch. And the only other thing is ruts are your best friend. Ruts are not bad. And that's really hard because in our minds, our minds don't think that. They look scary and we think that they're going to take us somewhere where we might not want to go. Go with the rut. Ruts are our friend. And when you can have those two things, at least those things help me. But I really suck in mud. That day at Cape Epic, that was just almost six hours of mud. That was really like just miserably hard day. Really hard. So, and the climbing part is the other one, Hannah. Like you mentioned weighting your tires evenly. Do you do anything else like with cadence or anything else? Are you high cadence? Are you lower cadence when it's slick like that?
On a climb, I would usually be higher cadence because that's what's going to allow me to maintain that even pressure. If I'm in a low cadence, I'm probably putting my weight down into the saddle and pushing too hard for what that mud is going to allow me to maintain traction in. So keeping that higher cadence allows me to focus more on where my body weight is rather than being forced to put my body weight into the pedals.
Nice. I guess the only other thing is just what Lee says. You can check out our YouTube video where we go through and we do mountain bike skills with Lee McCormick. It's called How to Be a Better Mountain Biker. Go check that video out on our YouTube channel. But he talks so much about getting low. And if you have a high center of gravity, poor Nate, Nate, you're just, that's like, you're not cut out for mud no matter what, because you always have a high center of gravity no matter what you do, right? Being so tall with long legs. But if you can lower your center of gravity, it just makes so that those moments when you lose traction, there's going to be less weight and inertia to be able to slam you down into that ground, you know? So it's like doubling down on keeping that chest low whenever you can. So then that your center of mass stays nice and low.
The other thing I would say when it comes to mud, especially if you're talking about muddy roots and rocks, those kind of things, is when all else fails, I'm really just concerned about the front, what the front wheel's doing. There's a lot of times on a descent where the root might slide your back wheel or the rock might catch your back wheel and fling it to the side. As long as I'm putting my front wheel where I need it to be, sometimes that's my main focus, is just keeping my front wheel. And when I can start to ignore all of that other noise, it really helps me. And like you were saying, you get scared about the traction. So if I can really hone in and say, well, my front wheel's good, it helps me get rid of some of that fear of that feeling of just chaos.
I did Telluride 50 and I had Aspens on and did not realize what was going to happen. And another Keegan was like, oh, it wasn't so bad. Then he goes, on the second lap, that was crazy. I'm like, Keegan, you realize your second lap was after everyone went, which is where I was, because he almost lapped me. Like, that is the that was the hard part. But it's the idea of sometimes too, you got to be patient for a second, where it seems like your wheel goes more like horizontal than forward. Your back wheel, you're kind of like spinning and you're just like, you're not even moving forward, you're kind of going sideways, and then it catches. And in your mind, it seems like that's about 3 minutes, but it's really like 2 seconds. Where as a beginner rider, I might, you know, unclip there as soon as I feel any movement to the left, because it scares me. But you can actually, you can save a lot of time if you just keep pedaling, just keep swimming.
Yeah. Dory. Yeah. Good tip. I like it. Well, thanks everybody for joining us. Hannah, good to have you. What's your next race?
My next race will be Crusher and Tusher.
Ooh, kind of a home race for you. Close to home, at least.
Yeah, pretty close. I'm excited about it.
Ooh, that'll be exciting. Eager to see it. Where can people follow you?
They can follow along on my Instagram, which is at Hannah_FinChamp.
Awesome. And Nate, where can people follow Trainer Road?
At Trainer Road.
Yes, exactly. Go to our YouTube channel, subscribe. You can hit a bell, that little click the bell thing. That makes it so that you see every time we make a video that comes out. We have race analysis videos coming out. We have a new Cycling Science Explained video coming out. If you didn't watch the one on blood flow restriction training yet, you got to watch it. Go check it out. We're going to have more coming soon. So go check that out. Rate this podcast on whatever podcast app you use, Spotify, everything else, and sign up for Trainer Road. We'll talk to you all next week.
Wait, oh, Nate, you're doing race analysis again too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just published one today. Well, as of recording on this today, and when you hear this, it'll be a couple days old, is with Zach Weimer, one of our fast support agents, and he's racing with his team. And it's a really good look at team tactics. And they talk about things that went well and things that did not go well, because there's communication breakdown in the race.
Yeah, it's P12, correct? In
P12. Yep, yeah. P12. And then we also have his Blue Dome Criterium. So the Tulsa race that I crashed at last year, Zach also crashed this year. so we're going to get to watch that one. But he was an actual pro race. So
GoPros on cameras, and then we analyze the race afterwards to see what the person could have done better or what they did better. It's a great, great way to learn race tactics.
Yep, and you get to see the power, the speed, the everything else, the wind direction, all that stuff. It's cool. It's super helpful. So go check that out on YouTube and become a faster cyclist. We'll talk to you all next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.